WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief, stated.
Good evening, and welcome to Civic Media's coverage of the Cap Times 2025 Idea Fest. Tonight, live from UW-Madison's Memorial Union, we will hear conversations with writer Evan Osnos and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, both moderated by David Marinus. At 7 o'clock following Osnos' remarks, Todd Albaugh of The Todd Albaugh Show will join us for some Idea Fest recap and analysis. Then at 7:30, Governor Walz will take the stage. We go now live to Memorial Union for Cap Times Idea Fest.
Good evening. It's so good to see so many of you here this early. There's always exciting traffic in Madison on a Friday night, and we know how hard it is to get here. So we're thrilled you're here early, and welcome. This is the fifth day of Cap Times Idea Fest, and we're excited that you're here. As I said all week, your attendance is so important to us to support the Capital Times and the news and opinion journalism we've been doing in this town since 1917. And I just want to keep repeating that every time I'm out here. If you're not already, consider becoming a Cap Times member. One of our plans for the future is to do more events and more member-only and member-first events. So, in addition to supporting us, if you're interested in events like this, you might consider membership. Please note our sponsors listed on the banners behind me. They, like your tickets, make this week all it is, and so I will just point out and thank them for their support. Our previous speakers this week have felt the topics have seemed really incredibly timely, not always all that optimistic, but incredibly timely. Even though I just met Evan Osnos for the first time backstage, I feel like he's an old friend because I've listened to him so long with his wonderful podcast, the Political Hour with The New Yorker, and I've been a huge and longtime fan. Evan is a celebrated New Yorker political reporter and author whose latest book was published in June. I got an advanced copy and read it. And it's for sale in the lobby, and I believe he'll be signing copies after this session and also after the Tim Walz session tonight. It's titled The Have and Have Yachts, Dispatches of the Ultra Rich. It's a collection of essays published in The New Yorker that Evan has revised and expanded to tell the story of how the ultra rich now hold more of America's wealth than even in the heyday of the Carnegies and the Rockefellers. In it, Evan recalls Donald Trump's inauguration last January in a scene he described as instantly indelible. The world watched American politics embrace plutocracy without shame or pretense, he wrote. Before joining The New Yorker, Evan worked as the Beijing bureau chief for the Chicago Tribune, and was part of teams that won a Pulitzer Prize in 2001 and 2008. Prior to his China assignment, he reported from the Middle East, mostly from Iraq. Among his other books was a 2020 biography of former President Joe Biden. In 2021, and we were talking about this in the green room, he published a best-selling book titled Wildland, The Making of America's Fury, in which he wrote about how the United States seemed to have changed in the many years he spent abroad, no longer appearing to be as committed to the rule of law, the sanctity of truth, and equal opportunity as when he left. That resonates with all of us now. As I said, Evan is a regular, I mispronounced it earlier, on the New Yorker podcast titled The Political Scene. It's one of my favorites. His New York podcast partners are Jane Mayer, who was here in 2021, and Susan Glasser, who was here with her husband Peter Baker last year. We were joking downstairs that we've completed our match set of podcasters, And now our goal will be to get them to Madison at the same time, maybe on the stage next year or sometime soon. I just wanted to give one more pitch for the podcast. I just find it to be fascinating and absent of the kind of off-putting hyperbole so common on podcasts. So David Marinus, who's been here all week, and played a huge part, invited Evan to Madison, and he'll be the moderator tonight. So with that, would you please welcome Evan and David to the stage? Thank you.
Hello again, and again, and again, and again. I'm sick of my own voice by now, but I'm delighted to be with an Osnos. I've known Osnoses since Evan was an infant. When I got to the Washington Post in 1977, his dad, Peter, was already a legend there, and he was in Moscow at that point, but I got to know him as an editor on the national staff. And my favorite Osnos story of all time is when I was the Southwest Bureau Chief for the Washington Post in Austin, and I went up to Dallas because Prince Charles was there. So I'm doing the story about Prince Charles, and he's meeting various people, and then he looks over and sees me and says, "Are you the Washington Post correspondent?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, I want to tell you that Peter Osnos, people come up to him and call him Prince Charles because he looks so much like Prince Charles."
It's uncanny,
actually. It truly is. And when I told him that story, boy, was he happy.
He remains pleased. He doesn't even know you're telling it, but somewhere a warm glow is passing over him, and he doesn't know why.
So now that he's King Charles, I guess your dad is King Peter.
Oh, he's so pleased right now. My dad is so thrilled by that. So
which
thank
means
you.
We have to call you Prince Evan.
Well, Dad, I have to say, I can take to that, actually. I have to say, it is as the other half of this prenatal friendship with David Marinus. When David Marinus sends you an email, even before you read it, you say, "Yes, whatever it is, I want to do it. I want to see you. I want to chat." So it is a great thrill to be here with you.
Thank you, Evan.
And thank you all for coming on a beautiful night outside.
Right. So Evan is one of the many guests we've had who came in from Washington. And each one of them, I have asked what it's been like there the last 3 weeks with sort of this mall cops police state. Yeah. What have you seen, and how would you describe it?
Do I have to go back? I mean, really? You see, I'm beaming at the experience of being out of Washington. It has been a very curious occasion because, let's be honest, the sight of the National Guard patrolling downtown, and I will point out, they are strangely patrolling around the monuments and some of the safest places. I think they're keeping the monuments safe from the tourists or the tourists safe from the monuments. Right. It's not clear. The subtext, of course, is a horror. The subtext is something that will be a subject for us to talk about tonight and for weeks beyond, which is that this is not how it's supposed to work. And we're getting used to what this has meant and what it will mean. But for the moment, I have to say, Washington has a way of registering its disapproval. And when J.D. Vance went to Union Station and thought that he would be greeted by rapturous crowds, it was a little bit like walking into hostile territory. And I think that was eye-opening. There is a way in which it feels a little bit, to me at least, having worked in Iraq, that the Trump administration operates in Washington a little bit like the Green Zone in Baghdad, where they kind of stay within the palace walls as much as possible. And we know from history that when you reside in the land of Oz and you begin to believe your own mythology and you don't step out and encounter reality, that can lead you into some disastrous choices.
Yes. And since we'll get to China later, but I was struck by the protester who threw the submarine sandwich and the way that the silhouette of that almost became symbolic, like the standing in front of the tank in Tiananmen Square.
Yeah, I do think the guy in front of the tank would like a word on that analogy.
Exactly.
But it is true that the sandwich has been immortalized with, yes, Banksy-style protests. Right. And, you know, I sometimes try to think about what would Gandhi make of this? If you'd explained to him that this was the nature of civil disobedience in our day and age. But look, it is a sign of how people are figuring out ways to register their discontent. And I think we're at the beginning of a process. One of the patterns that I look for is the way that citizen power marshals itself. How does it organize itself? It takes time. We sometimes forget that it took 20, 30, 40 years in some cases for great movements to achieve their definition of success. If you're talking about the suffragettes, if you're talking about achieving the first legislation during the Gilded Age to try to bring, in that period, the trusts under control. It took 17 years between the time that Mark Twain named it a Gilded Age and you had the passage of the Sherman Antitrust Act. So my message is, settle in. This is a marathon, not a sprint. As a citizen, this takes attention and it takes persistence. It's not a problem that gets solved overnight.
That's another translation of what Stacey Abrams said the other night.
Oh, is that right?
It was different, but it got to the same place.
I think that's what history tells us.
It was a measure of optimism that I think people were looking for in that sense.
Well, I mean, it is. I think we're all at this point, in some ways, looking for what history can tell us. There's a seductive comfort, which can be misleading too, to say, "Oh, you know, we've been through this. We've had moments like this before. That means we'll get through it." No, you know, as Robert Putnam likes to say, pendulum happens in history, but you sometimes have to push the pendulum. And I think the message there is that this is a set of values and a set of relationships that often happen face to face. You know, one of the great lessons of the progressive era, how we went from the Gilded Age to a progressive era, was that it took first a change of culture, in effect, a moral awakening of a certain kind, and then it led to civic action, people getting together, meeting in organizations, meeting to have talks and to exchange ideas and to throw out proposals to one another. And then the third step is actually policy. So in a way, the power begins in the hands of people who are interested in seeing an alternative way of living.
When you said the pendulum needs to be pushed, you started your career at the Chicago Tribune in Chicago, and J.B. Pritzker, the governor, will be here tomorrow night. And he's done some pushing, and it seems that that had an effect in Chicago. How would you interpret what's happened
with Trump and Pritzker? Yeah, it's very interesting, because part of the Trump strategy is a bit of the old probe. You know, you push until you see if you hit bone. And I think he began to get a sense that Chicago might not be such an easy place to invade.
Because?
You know, Trump always mentions these friends of his, like he's got this guy in Paris named Jim, right, who tells him about things that are happening. I'm always tempted to know if he had a guy in Chicago who called him up and said, "This isn't going to work. You're essentially going to organize the city in response to you." I think it matters the sequence. He started in Washington. Washington is, as you know, David, a kind of municipal. It's a very strange political creature. It doesn't have any of the ordinary powers that a city has. Chicago, where I came up starting on the Metro desk, I wrote a profile in the New Yorker of Mayor Daley, Richard M. Daley, the son of Richard J. Daley, who I, in an immortal phrase, used to refer to the rest of the country as the New Yorks, the LAs, and all that. And Chicago, as you know, has a kind of steel in its spine. And the idea that people were going to come in and tell this city that it was overrun, as Trump would say, by immigrants, by crime. Chicagoans will tell you, we're the only ones who get to criticize Chicago.
Right. That's great. So night after night, the guests from Norm Eisen to Stacey Abrams to Garrett Graff to Eugene Robinson have talked about where we are on the road to perdition, to autocracy. And two out of the four say we're already there. I've sort of listened to you about this, but I'd be interested in your perspective on how close we are to a total totalitarian state.
Well, I mean, having actually lived in something close to a totalitarian state, China under Xi Jinping, I can give you some points of reference.
Yeah.
I visited North Korea. Look, I think that the reason I don't mean to be jokey about it, is that when we use our level of alarm, we have to be sure that this is the moment that we're mobilizing people for. Meaning that if we actually say that Trump has reached the maximalist position of what he can take, that there is nothing left to be done within democratic politics, then what you're doing is essentially telling people that the democratic system is unavailable to you. It's failed. And that's not actually the point where we are. The point where we are is that we're in the run-up to a midterm election in which we could have some reasonable effect, some ability to contain his powers, some ability at least to begin to make the Congress function again. We could also, let's remember, begin to talk more seriously about how this country could, say, revive the tradition of amending the Constitution. We used to do that on average every 10 years. The last time we really amended the Constitution was 1971. We've lost the tradition. We've lost the memory of our founding system, our founding documents being a malleable document. I'm not suggesting that we're in any political position to begin amending the Constitution, but I think you have to begin to tell people to shift the Overton window, as we used to say a few years ago, an idea that's almost been exhausted, to tell people that politics is still an arena in which we have our best chance of peacefully bringing about the pushing of the pendulum.
You brought it up, amend the Constitution. What would you think, what would that amendment be? What would the first one come to your mind?
Well, I suppose there's a few things that one could imagine. I don't know if it would take an amendment of the Constitution to make D.C. a state, but this is an idea that has,
that's for sure,
has been rattling around.
Yep.
I'll secretly admit here that there is a fantastic book just coming out right now by my colleague at The New Yorker, Jill Lepore, on the subject of the Constitution and the power of amendment and relearning the muscle memory of what it means to make this a living, breathing document again. So I commend to you all that book. I'm going to be talking to her in Washington next week.
Great. Yeah, well, Jill Lepore is a national treasure.
She is an absolute national. Yes. And by the way, she somehow, in her spare time, manages to write 700 pages on the history of the Constitution while raising nice children and gardening. And teaching at Harvard.
And teaching, yes. So we're going to get into what's happened the last few days, but I want to set some context for that first. And in, I think it was 2015, you wrote a piece, The Fearful and the Frustrated, about the alt-right. You sort of saw it coming. Did you know what the way that would attach to Trump over the years?
Yeah, that was an experience of the value of going away and coming home. You know, I'm an American. I'm a reporter who had come up here. I'd gone overseas for a decade. And I came back, and as we all remember, Trump announced his candidacy for president in 2015. it happened to be that I was working on a piece at the time that had been inspired by this horrific shooting by Dylann Roof, who was a white supremacist who walked into a Mother Emanuel church and slaughtered parishioners. And that story was about this inchoate group of people who imagine themselves as white nationalists. Who was this group? What was this? What was the origins of this crime? So I was working on that piece, and I got a call from my editors at The New Yorker, and they said, you know, Trump has announced that he's running for president, and it was being treated as a great big joke. You remember, he was a, because in New York, of course, he's a piece of the kind of permanent media clownish furniture. That's the way that he was regarded. And so it was assumed he'll be out in a few weeks. This is all a publicity stunt. And they said, would you quickly pivot from the white supremacist story and do a profile of Trump, the candidate? And you better move fast because he's probably going to be out in a couple weeks. And I said, okay, so I went out and stopped meeting with these white supremacists and started going to Trump rallies. And I wrote to my editors after about a week of this. I said, this is one story, and we need to merge these two into one story. Because what this is about, it turned out, was a set of ideas that had been hatched, really, I would argue, around the idea of around 9/11 and the beginning of the war in Iraq, the idea of twilight war, the idea that we are beset from enemies. In that case, after 9/11, it was such a shock to our system, the idea that we would be attacked in a way we hadn't been since Pearl Harbor. And then gradually over time, you began to see that they said, okay, it's not just jihadists that were fighting in Afghanistan, it's also jihadists coming over the border. You remember that moment. There was even a congressman long since who's left politics named Tom Tancredo, who, for the power user, that is a name. If you recognize that name, you deserve a door prize. But he made this leap from saying this is not just about fighting for Western values overseas, it's about defending us from the enemies within. And that over time animated the birth of the anti-immigration movement. And Trump, of course, saw that and latched onto it and seized it, not as some authentic issue for him particularly. It was congenial to some of his pre-existing attitudes, but he picked it up, and you had this fusion of these two movements. And that it was a piece called The Fearful and the Frustrated, and it was about he had awakened a gene within us that's been in our national soul from the beginning, and it comes and it goes. And he turned it into the politics that we inhabit today.
And that was 2015 when Charlie Kirk was, what, like 20 or something. But he took that whole, I don't even know if you'd call it ideology, but whatever the movement would in those 10 years.
Yeah, I think that Trump as a phenomenon meant a lot of different things to people in the beginning. I mean, there were some people who thought he is the manifestation of what I don't dare say out loud, but what I feel, which is perhaps this fear of the country changing, particularly for white men. There was also a piece of that caucus who felt like they were actually reenacting some vision of a 1980s era Reagan style individualist ethic. That's what they thought that they were signing on to. And it was this conglomeration of different ideas. And then over time, as we know, Charlie Kirk started talking about young people. And I was reminded of this today, actually. We were taping the podcast this morning, and Jane Mayer, our friend, who has done a lot of work over the years, she'd interviewed Charlie Kirk. And the thing that had started him down this path was that, as in his mind, this is what he would tell people, he thought he could go to West Point. He applied, and in his mind, his seat was taken by a woman, and a woman of color. And he began to tell himself that this was a grand injustice. And he took this idea, and he went out into the world, and he found people who felt that they had been treated unjustly. And he was able to tap into this. He, in a way, he sort of picked a lock of something that was out there in the world, And it was very, very powerful. And he, look, the other reason, I don't know if you ever interviewed him, but part of the reason it worked was that he was masterful at code switching. He could figure out who he was talking to at one moment or another. And I think we don't need to, you've been talking about it all week, but we're at a very dangerous moment in this country. We're at a threshold moment. And the idea that the small d democratic method of change, which is that we can get into a room and disagree with one another, perhaps even violently disagree with one another, but do it without taking up arms, that idea is fundamentally imperiled right now. And it has been growing steadily since 2015. And we're at a point where, as a political class in Washington, the people who serve in our name, the only way we know from history, and this is very well documented by the scholars who fight against this, is they have to repeatedly, emphatically, creatively, and authentically renounce violence. They have to say there is no place for this in our politics. There is no place for this in our country. And if they don't do that, then this process builds over time.
And Trump renounces certain violence, but only the violence that suits his political needs.
Yeah, that's where we are right now. That's where we are.
So let you know, we will.
So is this the sunny turn in the conversation where we begin to talk about hope and light?
No.
No.
But we're sort of easing into China a little bit more.
Okay.
Karen Tumulty,
the authoritarian communist regime.
Well,
okay,
sort of, yeah. But it gets to, not to Charlie Kirk, but to young people, which was Karen Tumulty cited a study or a poll or something the other day that really fascinated me about the sort of the young people's perspectives on autocracy. And that part of why they're more, less disturbed about it has to do with China and all of the things they get from China, you know, from their cell phones to TikTok.
Yeah, I think there's also a way that they've grown up in a period when they look across the Pacific. And what do they see when they watch the Olympics a couple of years ago or in 2008? They see a place that is growing, that is building, that is putting up skyscrapers, that is laying down railroad track at a pace that was like us at the end of the 19th century. Now, what they don't get, of course, is the other side of the story, which is the people's voices who are silenced as a result of being in an oppressive autocratic regime, of being in essentially, of life in a one-party state. So if you look at China from over here, and what you're experiencing is TikTok and inexpensive housewares and the sight of spectacular infrastructure on TV, you can begin to say, you know, it seems like they're doing what we used to do, only bigger and better. But I think there's something else going on. And I actually think this begins to get to why inequality is a piece of the puzzle, is that I think what young people who are attracted to the seductive idea of a strong man, what they're really responding to, it's almost like a kind of referred pain. It's not exactly that strongman rule is so attractive. It's that they're looking at the present conditions in our politics, and they're saying, this system is not in any way reflecting the needs and the plaintive cries of people out in the country who are saying, what happened to the promise of what the mythology of this country is, which is, after all, that you can, let's say, you know, out-earn your parents. If you were born in 1940, you stood a 90% chance of out-earning your parents. Young people today stand less than half that chance. There are a lot of young people out there who say, if only we had a CEO. Now, it is, in my view, a radical misjudgment of how you actually achieve meaningful, productive political reform, but it is an expression of, in a way, a kind of politics of despair.
That's true. And this might not be true of the last few months, but in my experience of reporting, I've always found that the people who are most optimistic about America are the ones who have the least reason to be. Black women, Hispanics, You know, and it's... I don't know. I just
and I also and immigrants.
And immigrants.
I mean, I think to myself, you know, look, I am. You're kind of mentioned my dad at the outset of this conversation.
Yeah.
He came to this country as a refugee. He was a Polish Jewish family that they left Poland. They went on this odyssey, as so many families did. Families here, I'm sure. He was eventually born in India, of all places. My dad's birth certificate says caste Polish. True story. And he was given
where
the
did
middle
that fit
name.
In the caste system?
Well, no, he's out. They kicked him right out of India. That's where you were on the caste system if you were Polish. His parents had lost everything. My grandfather was one of seven siblings. He was the only one to survive the war.
Wow.
My father was given the middle name Winston after Winston Churchill because of just the idea that indeed, in word, you will put the idea of vanquishing fascism on a page, on a birth certificate, right there next to caste Polish. And they came to this country, and as you know, he says, I started here in this country in a basket. And the people who come here, who fight, and we know, all of us know people who have fought incredibly hard to get here. Those are the people who still believe in the American idea. And I know Chinese immigrants, for instance, who have trekked from China through the Darien Gap all the way up through Central America to get to the southern border with the United States because they want to get out of the Chinese system. So when we look across the Pacific and we say, God, it is nice how they're able to generate, build the new airports, let's remember that actually what we're fighting for here, it's a word I don't use as much anymore because I think it's layered. But
what, fighting?
Yeah, I've become a little bit more self-editing about the language of...
Mm-hmm.
The language of combat. I'm not sure it's necessarily the kind of language that is on my mind right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking more about the language of putting a shoulder to the wheel. You know, people sometimes ask these days, you know, what gives you hope? And I keep thinking to myself, I don't say it very often, but I think that's the wrong word. I use a different four-letter word. It's a family-friendly word, but it's work. It's work, honestly. It's the idea of... actually getting together with people who are concerned, getting together with people who believe that there is something to be done. And it's nothing, there's nothing wrong with saying we're going to fight. But
no, work is right. I mean, Marty Baron, my editor at the Post, you know, he'd say we're not at war, we're at work. You know,
yeah,
different variation of that same thing.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. I want to have an aside here. What, you know, Evan was talking about his father, Peter. One among many notable things of Peter Osnos was that he was the publisher of Barack Obama before anyone knew it was Barack Obama. He published Dreams from My Father, its first edition, when I don't know what it sold, but...
It sold in the high two figures, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, they got that book because Obama had signed with a bigger publisher and he'd gotten an advance and then he missed his deadline. The bane of every author. And so the book was basically put back out on the market like a tired old, you know, mule or something.
Right.
Somebody will pick up. And at that point, he wasn't yet Barack Obama. And so, but to my dad's credit, he bought this book. And I remember him saying, well, I've never said this, but I remember him saying at home, I think this guy could be president of the United States.
Yeah. I encountered many people who said that, but
I think if you read the humanism and the Americanness of that story in all of its complexity and its flaws and its rupture and its repair, in all of those elements, its candor, it's all of that, you said to yourself, that's sort of what we aspire to be. And that in the end, it was kind of the, you know, I think about this as an author and having a literate president is a powerful tool.
Yeah, they're few and far between, but there's some good ones there. I'm going to go back to China a little bit just to get to know you a little better. Did you know Chinese before you went there? When did you learn it? It's a very difficult language. You must be great at linguistics.
Well, I started in college. I got the bug as a college freshman.
Really?
It was a great professor who had a whole class on Tiananmen Square and the uprising at Tiananmen Square in 1989. And he was a kind of Oxford Don type. He was teaching here in the U.S. But he said it was a wonderful approach. He said, if you want to understand what happened on a single night, June 3rd in Beijing in 1989, we have to go back 1,000 years. And it was such a seductive way to teach because he said, and if you really want to understand it, you should probably learn the language. And that was the beginning of a process. And I started studying it as a college freshman, and it became a in some ways the guiding line of my life. I met my wife in China. She's an American. We happened to meet over in Beijing. And the only reason she would call me back is because there weren't very many Americans over there.
And you got there in 2005. And what's your name in Chinese? I saw
Yiwen. Oh, Yiwen. Yeah. My last name is essentially means European, which is a generous way of just saying big nose. It's kind of, they gave me that. And then Yiwen.
Yeah. And what was the daily life like there for you?
It was a golden age of journalism, of foreign correspondence in China. And I say that because it was this period when we were, you remember, China had embarked on this grand experiment in 1979, which Deng Xiaoping said, we're going to emancipate our minds. That was the quote. And what they meant was, of course, not give up political power, but try to create as much space in society where you could live a life without giving up the monopoly on force and power that the Communist Party had. And so what that meant was they said, we're going to allow foreign correspondents to come in. And so I came in as one of these foreign correspondents. They'd started doing it in the late 70s, early 80s. And you could travel all over the country. I had these kind of magnificent experiences. Like for a month, I decided to just walk in Sichuan province and kind of see what would happen. And the cops would come pretty much every day. And they would say, I just love the image of what they were getting some calls from somebody. People would say, there seems to be some lunatic Westerner walking in town. Can you come check him out? And they would come, but you could work.
Mm-hmm.
I did at one point a story where I said I wanted to understand what it felt like to be Chinese going out into the world for the first time. And so I joined a Chinese bus tour of Europe. It was 30.
Better than a Japanese tour, I guess.
Yeah, but, I wouldn't have understood a word on the Japanese bus tour. But it was 39 Chinese tourists and me. And most of them had never been out of Asia before. It was all kinds of small town folks. And we covered 5 countries in 10 days. We were moving fast. And I can tell you, we went to Marx's birthplace, little known place, not a place many of you have been, perhaps, in Germany. But we were only there for 11 minutes because we wanted to get to Paris in time for Louis Vuitton before it closed. So we had competing impulses.
Yeah.
And I will say that the reason why I call it a golden age for foreign correspondence was I was able to live in a little house in the middle of town in a very Chinese neighborhood. You didn't have to live anymore in these old compounds where they had already installed the bugs into every light fixture. They were really bothered that they had to come and install new new listening devices in my little house. But it was right before the advent of a new piece of technology, of a whole new world of technology, things like cell phones that everybody had with them, that they could monitor your text messages, that they could see where you were at any moment. We was just at the tail end, in effect, of the analog era. And so you were able to go everywhere. I would leave my cell phone at home so that if they were monitoring my cell phone, they would think, this lazy guy is just at home another day. And I could go out to all kinds of places in the country. Today, that is simply not possible. I was there most recently reporting in 2023 for the New Yorker, and it is very, very hard now because you worry about the effect on your sources, because people who agree to talk with you, you have to be thinking foremost about what's going to happen after I walk out the door. You don't worry as much about yourself, but what will the police and the state do? And so it's become incredibly difficult to do a lot of work on the ground now. my hat is off to the correspondents who are based there who are figuring it out. Because it is almost like, it's a little bit like a...
But there aren't that many.
There's right very now. Few. Yeah. There's very few. And you are actually quite literally in some cases aware of the fact. I've had this experience in recent years of reporting there where you contact somebody about an interview and then they get a phone call from the state security saying you shouldn't go to that interview. Mm. And even if that person is very brave and says, I want to do this, you as a reporter, you have a there's a level of almost informed consent you need from that person. You say to yourself, do they really know the full implications of talking to me? Because if they talk to me mm-hmm. and that story is instantly available everywhere around the world, what will happen to them? So it's made it a lot more complicated. And as a result, we know a lot less about what's happening.
Yes. But that's another reminder that for whatever's going on here, we're not there yet.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, and I think that's an important point to mention. I mean, I think that in the press these days are, you know, we have an allergy to being pushed around. That's kind of how what people who go into this business mm-hmm. are a little bit ornery by disposition. I think you would agree with that, right?
My wife might.
Yeah. She's been doing a longitudinal study for some decades. And we're now in a position where we're being called every day by this government, the enemy of the state or whatever the latest version of that is. And I think that people are using the muscles that they have in all the right ways, right?
So let's turn now to Have and Have Yachts, which is one of my favorite titles of all time. I'm hesitant to ask you this, but how did that title come about?
I was working on this topic, and I heard that expression in the UK.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I thought, boy, that is a wonderful little bit of language. And I said, I wonder if there's ever been a book by that title. And there hadn't been. And I said, you know, I really need to do this. And you'll appreciate this, being both a reporter and an editor at various points. Editors are convinced that writers never know how to title their own pieces. I just want you to know.
Yes.
It's true. And so I submitted this title as the title of a piece in The New Yorker, and my editor said, I don't know. You really, it seems, I don't know. And I said, no, I'm going to die on this hill. Like, this is the hill. I'm going out on this one. And so they said, no, let the guy have his title.
The only times that the publishers won on a title are the ones I regret.
Right. You know, well, that's
so,
true.
Yeah. So good
I
for
think,
you to get it there.
I think you
but I also want
field.
To say, I've read this book twice, and the first time I turned into a socialist, and the next time I turned into something even more to the left. I mean, you can't read this book and not just react. I'm exaggerating, but you know what I mean. So let's go through some of that and start actually with what's in the title, the culture of yachts.
Yeah.
First, you go down to Florida and describe sort of it's a fascinating and disgusting subculture.
Well, I got this. It was actually the idea of my editor, David Remnick at The New Yorker,
yes.
who said, you know, and this is the best kind of story is a story that can be suggested with just a single word. He said, what's the deal with these yachts? I said, right. Say no more. I'll be reachable in 6 months in Italy, I assume. But I had a real puzzle, which is, you know, I said, I don't really know the first thing about these things. And this is where being a correspondent, your training is basically you just go.
Mm-hmm.
You just go. And you start chatting with people. And I went down to the Palm Beach International Boat Show. I looked in my closet and I said, do I have anything that would be plausibly recognizable as a yacht
outfit?
Come
on, this guy.
Well, to be perfectly honest, I got down there and somebody asked me for directions. I was like, well, all right. Guilty. But what you quickly discover, and the reason why this became of interest to somebody who covers politics and foreign affairs, is that these objects, these machines, are, in a way, they are floating symbols of so much of what we've been talking about in this conversation, about politics and about economics. I mean, just as a practical matter, the biggest yachts in the world will cost you about the better part of $1 billion. They're as long as a football field, as long as a city block. They are, in fact, the most expensive objects that the human species has ever figured out how to own. More expensive than any real estate we've bought or sold in this country. More expensive even than the most valuable work of art, which was Salvador Mundi by Leonardo, mm-hmm. which not incidentally now hangs on the wall of a yacht owned by the Saudi crown prince.
Wow.
So there, we're all socialists now, yeah, I think. Yeah. But yeah, you know, the truth is that I just decided these objects, look, I'll there is a great tradition of a kind of writing at The New Yorker mm-hmm. that appeals to me, which John McPhee in the 1960s yes. wrote a magnificent book about frozen orange juice. And the reason it was frozen orange juice that he wrote about was this was a new thing in the United States of America that you could wake up on a January morning in Madison, Wisconsin, and have a spectacular glass of sunshine in a bottle. And it was partly because we developed the technology during World War II that we used for processing blood plasma and were able to apply it then to processing frozen orange juice. And mm-hmm. it also tapped into all of the new marketing power and the new ideas we had about publicity or propaganda and this kind of ascendant moment of American optimism. And he said, I'm just writing a book about orange juice.
Yeah, oranges.
Oranges. And in a way, I said, I'm just writing a book about boats. But you can, within that, begin to tell a story about how some of the most powerful people in our society imagine their responsibilities, their opportunities, their luxuries, and ultimately, in some cases, their seclusion.
I was fascinated by the caste system within that elite group. You know, you're in Florida, you're at what you think are the mega yachts, and then what happens?
Yeah, I was sitting there slack-jawed, standing in front of this enormous yacht, thinking, wow, I have gotten to the belly of the beast. And a guy taps me on the shoulder, one of the attendants, and he says, if you want to see the really big hardware, you got to go down to the other marina. And so I went down to see... I made a date to go meet some of the brokers who were buying and selling these. And I will tell you, if this hasn't touched your life personally, you may not know that we are living through the golden age of super yachts in the world. There has frankly never been as many of these things or as big as they are selling for the prices they are. And I went to see a broker who I was later trying to describe his mood. And I decided to describe him in the book as exhibiting an almost post-coital level of satisfaction. He had sold one yacht the day before. He was selling one that particular evening, and he was levitating into a kind of blissful stratosphere that I said, I'm going to need to try to contain this for the purposes of getting it on the page. But these objects, these machines, are... as you say, part of a caste system. And one of the things that's always the goal if you're a writer, if you're trying to get inside a nonfiction world of some kind, is not to look at it from the outside like, you know, me, and just saying, gee whiz, these things are awfully big. But to try to get in and say, what does it feel like to be one of these owners?
Yeah, well, you almost did.
Well, I had this experience.
In Monte Carlo, right?
I had a moment. I had a moment. I went to Monaco, and by the way, hazard pay was not forthcoming here. I've been asking about it ever since. But so I'm at the Royal Yacht Club of Monaco, and I check into my room there at the yacht club, and the yacht club is styled like a giant yacht. And I realized in that instant that I would never be fully satisfied anywhere else again. And the next morning, I'm out on my terrace, and I look down and I see a guy on a yacht. And I was there, I was eating an omelet and I had this glass of like preternaturally fresh orange juice. An ode to McPhee, I guess. I didn't even know it. And I'm looking at this guy down on this kind of mid-tier yacht, and he's looking up at me on my perfect terrace. And there he was. He was juiceless. And I had this feeling that just started somewhere in my chest. It was a strange sensation, and it kind of worked its way out. And I realized, this is what superiority feels like. There was a moment that really brought this home for me. The owner of one of the world's fanciest yachts told a guest, one of his friends, who told me that this owner had said to him, in the end, you know, why do I have this thing? He said, because, he said, you and I both fly on private jets, he said to his friend, the guest. You and I both have chefs. He said, so the only way I can tell the world that I am in a different effing category than you is the boat. And I thought when I heard that, I said, that really does capture the heart of this matter, which is about a kind of insatiability, a sort of hole within that people are trying to fill. And I think all of us now can look out into our public culture in this country at this moment. I don't need to name any names, but you know, just maybe a few people whose names rhyme with Elon Musk. And imagine why it is that a person does what they do. Why do they keep acquiring? Why do they keep exerting their control or their ability to shape the world in the way they do? And on some level, it is about insatiability.
So since you visited Marx's birthplace for 11 minutes, are these the excesses of capitalism or the inevitable ends of capitalism?
I think that we have lived through moments in our history that rhyme with this. Sometimes people will say, well, you know, the Gilded Age was pretty bad. We had... this is true that there were, during the Gilded Age, there were parties in New York City in the 1890s where people would arrive at a ballroom and be shown their way to a horse, and they would get on the horse and eat dinner in black tie on a horse with champagne in the saddlebag, just because they could. There was another party, a memorable one, that made the papers, where people arrived and were given a little golden trowel and were told to go and dig rubies and gems out of a giant pile of sand, and they could take home what they wanted. Now, that process, had it been allowed to continue, had that period in American life continued, there was a pretty deep belief, a growing belief among a lot of Americans that this country was cooked, that there was no way that you could continue on that way. You had vast inequality. You had life expectancy among the working poor that was declining. You had acts of abuse in mines out in Colorado, out in West Virginia. You had examples of grotesque abuses in the slaughterhouses in Chicago, and on and on and on. And there was a kind of awakening among some people that this can't go on. And it sounds perverse, perhaps, but it was Teddy Roosevelt and later Franklin Roosevelt who believed that in order to save capitalism, that what you had to do was rein it in from its most egregious excesses and abuses. I think it's worth saying, look, we're at a moment right now where the United States is capable of producing enormous wealth and capital, enormous opportunity through technology. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it needs to settle in the hands of a group so small that half of all American adults will tell you that they don't have $1,000 to spend in the event of an emergency expense. That is not how you build a country that is a muscular, thriving, stable, admirable model for the rest of the world. That's how you build a society that is something closer to oligarchy.
So I guess we're waiting for our next Teddy Roosevelt or FDR.
It's not as crazy as it sounds. Here's why. What did Teddy Roosevelt, what did he represent? Here was a guy who was a privileged son of the country. They both were. They came out of tremendous advantage. Teddy Roosevelt had also lived a life. You know, he'd gone around the country. He had been a rough rider. He had real jobs. He'd done things. He contained multitudes, to borrow the expression. And so when he came back and he said, look, all I'm saying is that we owe people a square deal, which is essentially the offer that he was making to people, they took him seriously on that idea. And they said, in a way, maybe he has some credibility because he's coming from the top of society. Why would a man with so many advantages bother to meddle in this question? I mean, later, of course, FDR was, as he said, you know, proud to be a traitor to his class. I'm not saying that we need to rely or wait on the most powerful people in society to decide that they're going to give up some of that privilege in order to make changes. But they are a part of the process. Right now, you see in clear, unambiguous terms, in New York City, the choice of Mamdani as a candidate, his mm-hmm. success in that race, is a blaring alarm about affordability in this country, about people who say, this is not the bargain I was promised in this country. And we do know from history that there are people who are at the top who begin to say, this doesn't work. I mean, already, curiously enough, I quote some in the book, people who are, you know, the titans of the hedge fund industry, guys like Paul Tudor Jones, who say, look, if you look back historically, inequality of this scale only ends mm-hmm. with war or revolution or, his particular concern, very high taxes.
But clearly that little cabal of Manhattan landlords and developers doesn't feel that way. They're trying to defeat Mamdani.
I think that's right.
And it's backfiring, I think.
It totally is. Yeah. They're discovering that there's no market for what they're pushing as an alternative. You know what's an amazing statistic to me, David? I've spent a fair bit of time over the years reporting from West Virginia. It was where mm-hmm. I worked. My first job out of college was at a little paper called the Clarksburg Exponent Telegram. I was a photographer there. I was a very bad photographer.
How did you end up there?
It was my first job. It was where I got a job. I sent out applications to a bunch of places.
Had you ever heard of it?
I hadn't until I applied, but I expressed rapturous affection. And most importantly, they said, yeah, we'll give you a job, $230 a week. And so I came down. And one of the things that is very notable to me is West Virginia, we think of now in shorthand in journalism as Trump country, right? Like the reddest place you can go. But in the 2016 Democratic primary, Bernie Sanders won all 55 counties of West Virginia.
Yep.
An amazing fact.
Yep.
And when he became unavailable as a candidate, and in fact, the data suggests that in a one-on-one contest, he would have beaten Trump. I mention it to say there are people all over the country who, if given the right opportunity, the right kind of candidate, the right combination of qualities, which we can't always predict in advance, they might be responsive in a way that would surprise us.
Another book that you wrote has to do with Joe Biden. And I'm curious about your perspective about Biden going in, coming out of the book, and then what happened after that with him.
Yeah, I got interested in Joe Biden, strangely, through the side door back in 2014 when I first moved back to the United States. I'd come back, I'd moved to Washington, David, and I didn't know anything. I didn't know anybody. And all I knew was foreign policy. I knew foreign affairs. And I knew that Joe Biden was working on a whole lot of foreign affairs. He would get a lot of, as he would sometimes say, I go to the places that Obama doesn't want to go. So he was in charge of a whole lot of tough patches, places like Iraq and things like that. And so look, Biden in Washington was a little bit of kind of, again, a piece of, people had sort of stopped noticing he was there. He was in the most maligned office in the land, the vice presidency. But I said, oh, maybe I can get an interview. So I called up. I said, you know, I'd like to request an interview with Vice President Biden. And they said, sure, yeah, how about tomorrow? And I said, okay, I guess we can. And what I discovered was that, as you already knew, the man could talk, and he would talk and talk and talk. And you watch the faces of his PR people, and they would just be ashen because he would say things, you know, he would say things like, you know, I shouldn't be telling you this, which is the sweetest expression a reporter has ever heard. And so I'd start, and I'd go back, and I'd go back, and I'd go back, and I'd go back. And I'll tell you the thing, the reason why in that period in 2014 when I started writing about, I wrote a profile of him in the New Yorker, essentially what seemed like the end of his political career was a kind of swan song story about this guy who'd been in public life all these years, never really grasped the brass ring and that kind of thing. What was interesting to me was that he had lived a real life. He had lost terrible things. He had lost his, as we all know, he had lost his wife and his daughter. He had bombed out of the presidency for plagiarism in 1987, didn't even make it to 88. We sometimes say the 88 race, but he was out even before then. He then had two aneurysms right afterwards. They said, you might not ever speak again. That's what the doctors told him. He was read his last. And by the way, when they told him that, it was after the plagiarism scandal, and he said, you know, that could have helped me, actually, a few months ago. So all of this stuff had happened. And the reason why it was interesting to me is Washington is a place where usually people have led lives. The reason they got there is because they had the Rhodes Scholarship, and then they cruised into Washington and started measuring the drapes. So they haven't lived all that much life. Joe Biden, he had a sort of silver medalist's mindset. Like, he was constantly aggrieved. He had a chip on his shoulder, and that was this engine that powered him. And eventually, through the strangest turn of events, you know, in 2016, of